Welcome to Funding and Disrupting, the most in-depth business podcast for companies looking to raise money and the investors who fund them. Every episode, we interview a funded founder, plus the investor who funded them, to get the real story of how it all came together. If you're searching for funding for a disruptive technology or business, or you're searching for the best companies to invest in, then you've come to the right place. This episode of Funding and Disrupting is brought to you by Aura Collective, a leading tech PR and marketing firm. Let's get funding and disrupting.
Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Keith Herman, and welcome to today's episode of Funding and Disrupting. Today, my special guest is Daniel Ebrie, the co-founder and managing partner at Mindset Ventures, a VC firm focused on early stage tech investments in the U.S. and Israel, providing access and meaningful connections to help brilliant minds break through. And now let's hear from Daniel Ebrie. How are you, Daniel?
Great, Keith. How are you? Thank you for the invitation.
Sure. Thank you for joining us today on Funding and Disrupting. Where are you calling in from today?
I'm actually calling in from Miami today. My base is officially in São Paulo, Brazil, but I've been, you know, traveling all over recently. So hard to know where I'm calling from. It's a good question.
Wonderful. Well, I'm actually in Los Angeles, and I do travel a lot as well and frequent Miami as well. And I was also in Brazil a few months ago. So I understand the travel and appreciate you taking the time to be with us and sharing your story. Very interesting story. I know everybody's going to be excited to hear. So I see you have a very interesting work history, having lived in many countries. And so I wanted to find out a little bit more about that. Is that because you were following job opportunities with your area of expertise, or because you have an interest in seeing the world?
Actually, I lived, honestly, most of my life in Brazil, like born and raised in Brazil. I spent a lot of time like traveling and you know, getting to know other countries. I lived in the US for a short while, but I wouldn't say I really lived in a few in different countries. I'd say mostly I tried to experience that. And now being an international VC, what I really like doing is like, you know, connecting the dots across borders and, you know, going beyond the continental barriers to really try to bridge companies, founders, technologies, et cetera, across countries. So I think it's a passion of mine, and I love, you know, seeing different like entrepreneurial ecosystems, how entrepreneurs behave in different cultures, different styles, with their different educational backgrounds. So that's been of a big interest to me. So I've been, you know, going to the US, Europe, and Israel in the past years quite frequently.
Well, that's exciting. So why don't you tell us a little bit more about Mindset Ventures, for instance, when it was founded? How did you decide on the name? Do you have other partners? Give us the background on it.
Sure. So going a little bit to like two steps back. So I started my career in the management consulting world, like typical, you know, strategy consulting for big companies, stayed a few years there and started mentoring startups in Brazil back in 2009. And doing some angel investments. And really, when I got into it, just because, you know, they invited me to, you know, mentor some startups, I didn't know what it was about. And I very quickly completely fell in love with that and saw the, you know, the spark in the eyes of the entrepreneurs trying to build great things. And that was my, you know, desire to really help those great people build great companies. So after, you know, a couple of years doing that, I decided to shift my career, left the consulting world for the VC world, built my first fund in Brazil in 2011 to invest in Brazilian early stage startups. It was a very interesting time when the local ecosystem was just, you know, getting started. The fund did very well. Then I was invited in 2015 to be the CEO of a multi-corporate fund in Brazil that was backed mostly by Microsoft. So Microsoft wanted to do, you know, this corporate venture group in Brazil together with other companies to invest in Latin American startups and help them grow. So we brought together not only Microsoft, but also Qualcomm, Monsanto, and other big Brazilian, you know, players, banks, etc. So I was the CEO there running that fund. But over time, what I realized was that, you know, although Brazil had a lot, and Latin America in general had a lot of opportunities, and the ecosystem was starting to really enhance, I saw this lack of connection between the foreign ecosystems. And when you look at, you know, in the US, in Israel, in some countries in Europe, you see they are so much more advanced in terms of like technology development, etc. And I saw that, you know, Latin America could be not necessarily the place to build or start great companies, but also the place to expand great companies as a potential big market for these technologies, right? So from there in 2016, the mid of 2016, we spin out of that corporate fund to create Mindset Ventures. And the idea was to be the, you know, probably the first and only Latin American VC or Latin American born VC, because we consider ourselves more international than, you know, Latin American these days, but the Latin American born VC, completely international cross borders and trying to connect the dots between these countries. So we decided to focus initially on the US and Israel. So that's what we've been doing so far. So investing only in these two geographies, but helping those foreign startups to expand to Brazil and Latin America whenever it makes sense. Of course, it's not an obligation, but that's one of the value adds, is trying to tackle this big economy that is Brazil and Latin America. Very hard to get in if you're not local, if you don't speak the language, know the culture, etc. That's what we try to bring as value. So that's how we got started. I got started with co-founder Camila Potenza, who's, you know, still works with us and leads this value creation team. And more recently, we brought another managing partner called Neymar Rahal. So now we are a team of 12 people spread between, you know, the US, Tel Aviv, and São Paulo.
Wonderful. So let's talk about that. So you have a team, you said 12 people now. So who decides which companies get funded? You have a whole group of people. In other words, is there a committee of a certain amount of people, or is there a separate investment committee? How does that work?
Yeah. So to be a little bit more organized, we divided the company in basically four areas, right? So there's the like the operations / back office, which is, you know, typical back office admin stuff. We have Camila, my partner, leading what we call value creation. So everything that relates to adding value to portfolio companies, either on this international expansion, funding new rounds, hiring people, you know, opening sales doors and all that. So that's what she handles with her team. Then Neymar, my other partner, handles everything that is investor facing and outside facing. So everything that is like investor relations, fundraising, investor reports, growth strategy and all that. So Neymar leads that with his team. And I lead the investment team, right? So in my team, I have four more people. So two in Israel, two in the US. So my team is like fully outside of the Latin American region. And though this is the team handling the investment, right? So my team and my partners in Israel and the US, those are, you know, sourcing the deals, speaking to the companies, doing kind of the first like filter and analysis, whether it fits the thesis or not. We get together every Monday to, you know, review the pipeline, review the deal flow, discuss the opportunities, etc. And for those companies that are interesting and a potential good fit, we start doing a very thorough analysis and, you know, process. And at the end, if the company kind of like survives the process, we go through everything, you know, we do the diligence, we're very confident it's a good deal, then we submit to our investment committee, and then we have a, you know, specific governance, we vote, approve, and then execute. So this all can happen very fast or very, you know, or take more time depending on, you know, timing for the round, speed of the startup and all that.
And how many people are there on the investment committee that actually to get to make a decision?
So normally we do five votes. So all the teams, so we have a dynamic that all the Mindset team joins the investment committee meeting. We always call the founder of the company to pitch everyone because, you know, my team, which is the investment team, we know the company for sure, but not the rest of the team knows. So we bring the founder, it pitches, everybody does Q&A, then, you know, the rest of the team and the founder leaves, and then the five people actually deliberate and vote for yes or no.
Now, I'm sure you have tremendous deal flow, right? There's no shortage of deals, right? So
yeah.
How often, you're looking at a lot of deals, you're doing due diligence, you're sitting in on these meetings, and then everybody has something to say. So how often are you disagreeing on who to fund? I mean, is it always like, it's always, you know, a slam dunk, everybody says yes, or is it, you know, 4-1, or is, like, how close is it generally, you know, when you decide on funding a company?
Yeah, great question. The majority of the deals so far have been unanimous, but not all of them, right? So we approve by majority. So it needs to have my vote as the CIO. So if I say no, at the end it's no, but I need to say yes, plus the rest of the majority, right? So the majority of the deals so far have been unanimous. Everybody was convinced, but we have approved some deals where we approved by majority and maybe one or two people were kind of against it. And I have to say that those are the most interesting deals and probably the most likely will, you know, be much more successful just because they are not obvious, right? They have something that intrigues people that say, you know, this probably won't work. And people say, this might work. And if it works, maybe huge. And then the majority decides to bet. And, you know, if it works, it's really a big success. So those controversial deals are the more interesting ones.
Yeah, there's always somebody who finds brilliance in an idea that maybe not others see, right? So
exactly.
So it's always interesting to get that input. So who's the easiest to convince and who's the most difficult?
Among my partners. I'll say like we try. So one of the dynamics that we do is if the deal is a U.S. deal, my partner Jules, who leads everything that's U.S. related, is kind of the sponsor of the deal. So she's like defending the deal to the others, right? And if it's Israeli, it's both my Israeli partner. And they need to convince their peers. So if Jules is kind of pitching a U.S. deal, Boaz needs to be convinced that even though it's not an Israeli deal, it's a U.S. deal, it's a good deal for the fund because they all make money on the same stuff. It's not separated, right? They all get on the same bucket of carry and profits. So, what I like to see is that they, of course, they challenge each other, but they trust each other's decision and gut a lot. So it's very good to see if someone is very strong saying, I'm very convinced I want to do this deal. The others are like, okay, I trust you. No, it's your job. I haven't met the company, spend time with them. I trust you. Let's go. You know, so they are easier. And I'll say maybe Nimmer, my partner, who's the more senior guy here who spends like 22 years in private equity and is dealing with the investors. He's the more like critic one saying, you know, is this really within our teeth? Can we explain this to investors? Are they going to like the deal? Is it really a safe bet or a good bet for us in terms of like future? So he's the more critic one. Not sure. Necessarily the hardest, but the more critic.
Sure, because he has to do all the explaining.
Exactly. So if we mess around, he needs to explain to the LP.
Exactly. Okay. So so I know that you've had several funds. So let's talk about mindset, the portfolio. How many companies do you have now in the company, and have you had any exits so far?
Yeah, we are raising fund four now. So we started in 2016, as I mentioned, with a very small fund one, just like a pilot fund, more or less. Then 1 year later, did fund two, which was almost like a continuity of fund one. Then fund three at the end of 2019, early 2020. Now raising fund four, which is aimed at $100 million. We have raised around 20% of that already, did a first close. So, you know, it's besides the market time is not the greatest, but it's going well. So far, we invested in around 60 companies over this 6.5 years that Mindset is up and running. We made 8 exits and 2 unicorns. So that's
it's a horrible track record. It's you should be ashamed of yourself.
it always can be better.
Yeah, well, it could always be better, but I mean that's something to be.
No, it's
proud
going
of.
Great. I think that is we are and I think the not proud only of the results. Like the results are great, the IRR of the funds is great, etc. But I'm very proud of the founders we backed and the great stories they're building and the great companies and great tech. So when you look at the portfolio and see, oh my God, I have so many great companies and great cases here, so that's what really makes me proud.
I'm curious about something in particular. A lot of companies they have a progressive way of thinking, meaning they start at one point and then kind of move forward and aren't necessarily thinking down the line in terms of their company. So with that in mind, when Mindset considers an investment, How important is the company's exit strategy? I mean, are you interested when you look at the company how the company is looking to exit, whether it's a sale or, you know, an IPO, or, I mean, is that on your mind when you're investing, the exit for a liquidity event?
It is, but not necessarily on that approach. So when we think about exits, there's maybe two. So one thing we learn is, you know, it's almost impossible to predict exits, right? It can happen much faster than you expected. It can much longer. You think this company can IPO, they will, you know, sell to a strategic in 2 years for a very small multiple. So it's very hard to forecast that. So two things that we are concerned. One, is it what is the likelihood of an exit in this specific segment with this specific technology? What are the potential multiples if they, you know, succeed in scaling and reach their target in, you know, revenues, whatever? So the likelihood of exit and the potential liquidity of the deal is something we are concerned. Not necessarily, you know, trying to forecast the time, whatever, but, you know, this. And second, trying to understand the founder's mindset, you know, about the exit. Like, are they willing to, you know, build a big business, stay on the run for 10 years, go through the ups and downs to make it, you know, a big success? Or if someone puts like $50 million on the table in 1 year from now, they just, you know, want to be settled and done and go back home, you know? So trying to understand what motivates them and how they see that, you know, end of the game is something that's important over the process.
Now, tell us about your deal flow, like the volume of your deal flow, so that people get an idea of how many deals you see, and then give us an idea of your investments in terms of like the checks that you write, the size of the checks that you go in. And I know that it varies, but tell us about the deal flow and the checks that you're writing.
Yeah, so I can give you a very good proxy from our latest fund, right? So last fund three that we recently ended the investment period and ended the investments. So we did 20 deals on that fund, and that was the target. So right on target. We had 3 years to deploy initial checks over the investment period. We did it in like 2 years and a half. And to get to these 20 invested deals, we looked at around 5,000 companies, right? That's the number we have on our CRM. So for like 5,000 companies in 2 years and a half to make 20 investments. So it's a very, very, you know, steep funnel. Of course, a big majority of that you like discard at the beginning is just because they don't fit your thesis or the initial criteria you're looking for. But then there's a big, you know, filter after that, going through the process and the diligence and, you know, making sure it's a good deal. So about the check size that you asked. So nowadays, talking a little bit more about the thesis more broadly. So we invest only in the US and Israel, as I mentioned. That's important for us. Second, we only do B2B and only do software, right? So we don't do anything that's consumer, no biotech, no hardware, only B2B software. We do early stage. So officially, we can do anywhere from C to Series B, but I'd say around Series A is kind of the sweet spot. So we like companies that are early stage, but they have some traction and some demonstration of product market fit. That's important. And we usually don't lead the round. We try, you know, to co-invest with local meaning US or Israeli VCs, and trying to be the partners that like add value, enable them to expand geographically abroad, et cetera, et cetera. So not to lead the deal, not to be the biggest list in town, but to be the best value add for the founders. And in terms of check size, so we do initially, let's say between 1.5 and 3 million when we join. And then we tend to at least double that over time in follow-ons as the company goes through.
I'd like to talk about one investment in particular and that we can use as an example. And that company is called PayJoy. And I'd like to learn more. Tell us about that company. What exactly do they do?
So PayJoy is an amazing story. So it's a U.S. San Francisco-based startup in the fintech space. And what they developed is a technology that can remotely lock a smartphone, right? Especially those from Samsung, Motorola, it's especially Android-based. And what that enables you to do is to use your smartphone as a collateral for credit. And that's very interesting because if you look at especially developing countries, and that's what we like about them a lot, you see that for the poorer, you know, classes of the population, sometimes the most expensive item they purchase in their life or the most aspiring item is a good smartphone, right? And they use it for everything. They use it for work. They use it to communicate with their friends. They use it to make payments and everything. But if you go to like Brazil, just pick an example, Mexico, India, Africa, whatever, you normally go there and you try to pay that in like 10, 20 installments because you don't have enough money to buy a smartphone, a good smartphone up front, right? And you don't have credit in your credit card as well as a limit. So the store normally provides you credit and they finance like a buy now, pay later stuff that you see in the US, right? What you can do with like PayJoy's technology is that you can provide the credit to this person. And if they, you know, install the app and accept the terms, you can remotely block their smartphone if they don't pay what they're due, right? So you kind of collateralize the smartphone as a guarantee for the credit you're providing. So you can do this for financing the smartphone itself. So saying, you know, Keith, I'm going to sell you this smartphone. I'm going to finance you in like 10 installments. If you don't pay, it's going to be locked and completely unusable. Or I can provide you a credit, like an unsecured credit for whatever reason you need, like $100, $200. If you have a smartphone, give me that as a collateral. So can I can assure you lower interest rate and faster credit. And if you don't pay, I'm going to block it. And for these people that have the smartphone, as important as they are, having it blocked and losing like all your contacts and pictures and whatever, it's very painful. So they will find a way to pay. And this shows that, you know, delinquency rates have dropped at least 50% in the countries that they run.
Now, with the particular round that you entered with PayJoy, how much was that funding round? And do you recall who it was that led the round? And how much did Mindset contribute?
Yeah, so I'll share the numbers that I can, not always public, but sure. We invested in a pre-B round. And by that time, we invested because not only, again, great company, great tech, great founders, etc., but their main thesis was to go to developing countries. So they're operating in the US, but the biggest market was Mexico. And they were aiming to go to Brazil, go to South Africa, go to India, etc. And they saw us as the, you know, entry point to the Brazilian market. And that actually happened because we helped them hire the country manager. Now they already have like, you know, 10, 20 people on the ground in São Paulo. Operation is going amazingly well in Brazil. So we've been helping them very hands-on on that. And that's why we invested. So we did a check size at that time. We were investing out of fund two, if I'm not mistaken. So check size a little bit smaller than what I told you. So no. Closer to the million range than upper tier. And then they raised a Series B right after, led by Greylock, if I'm not mistaken. And then more recently, they raised a Series C. I'm not sure that's public or not, but, you know, the company is going, you know, very, very, very well. So growing very fast and, you know, expanding abroad.
Tell us about your first encounter with them. Who was it that you were introduced to? And do you remember, you know, was it a phone call? Did you meet them in person? And what did you discuss initially?
Actually, that was an interesting story. So I met a guy that is not there anymore, but he was a Mexican guy that was the guy responsible for international expansion and expansion to whatever, outside the US or Latin America. It was still pretty small for them. So they were trying to tackle international markets. So that was the guy, like former Wharton MBA, amazing guy, you know, and he was trying to expand abroad. And he actually reached out to me, or we got connected because, you know, he said, I'm trying to understand a little bit about the Brazilian market. I know it's big, but I know there are some challenges. And I spoke to some people here in the US, you know, with our investors and others. And I heard that you are the ones who help companies, you know, American companies expand to Brazil. So it seems like you're the guy to talk to, and I'd love to hear from you about your experience, success case, etc. And I said, oh, amazing. You're writing within our thesis as well. I'd love to contribute. So he was coming to São Paulo, I think, 2 weeks after that initial approach by email. So we met in person 2 weeks after in São Paulo. I really liked the guy, really liked the company, and I started helping them. So I started, you know, introducing them to people, taught them a little bit about the Brazilian ecosystem, etc. And then I say, you know, I'm also very interested in investing. Is there an opportunity? And he said, you know, we might be raising kind of a bridge round soon to onboard strategic investors that could help us abroad. So then he connected me to Doug, the founder and CEO, and also Mark, the other co-founder at the time. We met over phone, met in person, really loved the guys, went through our process and ended up investing with Bridge.
Very often when you meet the first time, it, you know, it's not exactly always clear what the company's doing, the direction that they're going in. What, do you remember what your initial impression was of the project when you first met? I mean, was it crystal clear? Were you uncertain? What was, you know, that initial impression? Because very often it's wrong. So, yeah. Do you remember, if you can?
I think I would say two things that I remember. One, that they were, that I agreed with their international expansion focus in terms of like going to developing countries, but they were thinking a little bit wrongly about it and the approach and the speed, especially. It's not easy. You need a lot of resources. It takes a lot of time that people, you know, take it for granted a little bit. So I remember, you know, we kind of tried to show them a little bit how it really worked. And second, I think it wasn't clear at the time whether they would be or how they would be using the technology, right? So the technology was great, but are you going to provide like unsecured debit and collateralize the phone? Are you going to sell this as a SaaS to the merchant or to the, you know, retailers so that the retailers can sell smartphones and they will be buying your SaaS and then going to the customers, or you're going to the customers directly and using that to give credit? So that wasn't clear. And they kind of shaped that strategy over the years, honestly. And it's still, you know, kind of a work in progress. Although there's the direction, I think when you have a great tech that can have many different use cases, I think sometimes it's hard to find a sweet spot and really tailor to that.
Yeah, I think this is a great example because it's not always crystal clear, right? And companies need time to evolve and develop, and they need help. And for people who are raising money, there's not everything is crystal clear, and your plan is exactly how you're going to, you know, execute what needs to be done, right? It's evolving. So I think this is a great example for especially tech founders who are looking to raise capital, that there are some things that there isn't a crystal clear answer to, or you're going to have to pivot. But it's great to have somebody on your side, right, that has resources that can help you, especially you're talking about helping somebody get into a market that they didn't really have any experience. So
sure. I think one thing that is, it's also important, and we're always evaluating, right, over diligence, is how coachable the founders really are, right? Because if you see something that is not, on your opinion, the right direction, you try to help them like think about it or pivot, and you see how coachable they are. If they accept your criticism, if they actually think about it, they don't need to agree, but if they really take it into consideration or not. Because the worst thing is to work side by side with founders that really don't listen to you. They just do what they want. Sometimes it works, sometimes not. So it's not a good experience.
So tell us, how long did it take until you were ready to be an investor, right? You met them. Clearly there were some things that were a bit nebulous, and you're trying to figure out how do we work together, right? How long did it take until you said, this is, you know, I think we're ready to make an investment here?
In that case, I think it was pretty quick. I think I would say around a month or so until we gather all the information, the documents, did some market assessment, you know, spoke to clients, you know, either current or potential clients, also explored a little bit the potential of the Brazilian market, which was they wanted us to help on, and, you know, really see if we could help and add value. So I'd say maybe a month until we got comfortable in investing.
And then once you got comfortable, how long did it actually take you to write a check?
Once approved, very quick. So once we approved the deal in our committee, it's like legal review and negotiation can take like 1 week. Then we sign, wire, done. So pretty quick.
So within 60 days, basically, with that particular,
yeah, or less. Maybe 60 days from first meeting to running the account, I'll say 60 to 75 days. All done.
Terrific. So now let's touch on something a lot of people may not want to discuss. What was the most challenging part of closing that transaction?
So that transaction specifically, I think it was quite easy. I think the challenge there was it was a bridge round, as I remember, right? So you're not necessarily looking into a lead or looking into a, you know, a defined valuation, etc., because it's all concurrent and conditioned to the next round and what's going to happen. So that's always a little bit tricky situation when you join a company at that stage. You need to be very sure about the potential, how the, you know, valuation is going to evolve over time, if they're going to have a good lead for the next round or not, because you don't necessarily have a lead and you're not taking part of the governance because it's also a convertible note. So that's always a little bit tricky. And also, I remember it was pretty much oversubscribed. So I remember we wanted to invest a little bit more and didn't have space. And that's just part of the job.
Now, you had mentioned that mindset likes to, you know, co-invest in rounds, but very often you are not the lead investor. So I'm curious, do you generally communicate with other investors before you commit funds?
Always. So we always speak to the leads, try also to leverage on their experience, their learnings during the process, their diligence, because it's kind of a double check for us. That's very important. And we love working with leads that we know and, you know, trust, because those are normally the people that are on the board. They are taking care of the governance. They are taking care of helping the startups in other ways. So working with people that you like and trust, it's good and generates value to the companies. Moving forward, for sure.
What advice, now you had mentioned that you're an international VC. So what advice would you give to tech founders looking to raise capital across borders?
Very good question. I think, you know, most of the VCs, interesting enough, are not prepared to do cross-border checks, right? And VCs still are a very local business. So if you're not close to the company, if you're not close to the founders, like physically speaking, even though we're in the distributed world nowadays, but if you cannot meet them in person, if you cannot help them, if you cannot, you know, attend meetings, whatever, it's very, very hard for most of the VCs to do deals there far. So you see, for instance, the US, which is the perfect example, that you have funds that are focused on a very tiny geographic area. So I'm focused on whatever, Illinois state, right? So, you know, very area, but that's the area where I feel I know the culture, I know the space, I know the people, I can get references, I can help companies. So it's very hard to go to do the big outreach. And most of the VCs who tried, they do one of the two things. Either they develop local funds. So Sequoia is a good example, right? They develop Sequoia India, China, whatever. So local funds with local LPs, with like local teams, etc. Or if they're investing out of the same fund, they have a local people on the ground taking care of the geography, which are not many funds that do. Like that's what we do, but not many funds do that. So if you're just raising money, so a lot of like Brazilian founders get to me and say, hey, I have this great startup. We're doing very well. I want to raise money in the US. What do you recommend? I recommend don't go, because you're going to waste a lot of time. You're not going to raise. It's going to be very few funds that will be able to invest in a geography they don't know, don't have experience, don't have boots on the ground, right? Unless you know, reshape yourself to being, let's say, a US company. So incorporate in the US, move to the US, you know, find clients in the US, then you're a US company, you can raise with US VCs. But you know, being foreigner, it's always easier to look for local VCs or VCs who have really boots on the ground.
Now, you are obviously still putting out capital, and you said that you like to co-invest, and you're still raising, trying to finish closing out your round. So, how many people get in touch with you if they're interested in participating in that round or co-investing, or if they're seeking capital? How may they reach you?
Yeah, I'm pretty accessible either through email. So my email is daniel@mindset.ventures. So three words, easy. Or you can reach me out on LinkedIn as well. I'll try to be very responsive. Daniel Ibri, LinkedIn, you're going to find me.
Fantastic, Daniel. Thank you so much for sharing your time and experience with us today. We wish you
my pleasure.
Wish you the best in your endeavors. And that's it for today's interview. If you're a VC firm or tech founder and would like to share your interesting story, please visit us at fundingdisrupting.com. Thanks again for joining us. Until next time, keep funding and disrupting.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Funding and Disrupting. Don't forget to visit our sponsor, AuraCo.com, to learn more about working directly with Aura Collective's exclusive technology PR team. They'll help you craft your message, get noticed in the press, and help you get your venture to the funding finish line. Again, you can visit them at www.auraco.com. Keep funding and keep disrupting.